Welcome to Your Money Today, a unique look at financial, geopolitical, and other news relevant to you. For 45 years now, your host, Chris Temple, has provided his one-of-a-kind insights and advice on the markets and on our world. Whatever the subject, he calls them like he sees them. Roll up your sleeves with Chris as we get into today's program.
Welcome back, everybody. In this episode, as I promised a while ago, and I think it's especially timely now, with some renewed confusion as to what's going on with precious metals, that I resurrect and update my probably best known special report over the years on precious metals. And as you already saw from the title here, I'm using the same one because it's appropriate for a lot of reasons. This is still not your father's gold market. Now, we have seen a lot of stuff go on over the last, I would say, year and a half or so. Everybody in Fat City, long-suffering gold, and then silver bugs, ringing the cash register, popping champagne corks, and all of a sudden in the recent past, very sharp corrections that have damaged a lot of people's psyches a bit. I don't believe the long-term trend has changed, but a lot of people got caught with their pants down that didn't realize that these parabolic moves we had in gold and then again in silver were unsustainable. And also beyond that, folks, the broader, I think, macro picture right now, which for the foreseeable future is not going to allow either gold or silver right away to get back to those highs that we saw. Of course, here's a couple of charts on the screen for those of you watching the video version of this. You see the sharp pullbacks. More so, and this is an opportunity for people who have wisely managed their portfolios and don't have so much money that they had in precious metal stocks at the recent top that they don't have a lot of fresh powder and they've got to wait, you know, to get whole in the next move up. If you have a lot of fresh powder, this is a time to start buying individual stories again. I would not be buying sector-wide in precious metals. And I'm going to explain to you the distinctions of how I look at individual stocks, ETFs, for the metals themselves, ETFs for the mining stocks, and occasionally inverse ETFs for the mining stocks. I'm going to talk about all that later when I get to some of the do's and don'ts of how to be a successful investor in precious metals. But a lot of the stocks recently have really taken drubbings, undeservedly. But that's the nature of this sector and has been for a lot of years. And continually I see people who stay at the party a little bit too long, get too religious, as gold and silver bugs unfortunately tend to do. And then after riding a lot of stocks up, they ride them right back down. And I remind people all the time, if you have a 50% loss, and a lot of good gold and silver stocks recently are down that much at the lows of a couple of weeks ago, you need 100% gain to get back to where you started. So I'm going to talk about some lessons a little bit later too, as far as how you manage your allocations. You have to have ebbs and flows depending on what the market is telling you, and you don't ever get religious and dogmatic and think you've got to be 100% precious metals 100% of the time, because that has never worked. It hasn't even worked these days when we've had gold well over 5,000 an ounce and silver popped 100 bucks. Complicating the story in the recent past is that a lot of people claimed, and those, of course, are the ones that are the precious metal specific gurus out there. You've heard me say, you probably heard others say, when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And a lot of people who shill for or sincerely believe only in precious metals, they don't ever have a bone in their body that says sell. They don't ever question their own rhetoric, because it's got to be always rah-rah gold, rah-rah silver, etc. And what's confused a lot of them, and a lot of people who came to the party late and then, you know, left in a hurry, which is why you had such big sharp corrections in silver and gold. Those people thought at the beginning of the Iran war, the last day of February, that we were going to see even bigger gains. I, on the other hand, did a podcast. Some of you listened to it back then, and a short video snippet on our social media channels, and I explained the reasons why the first night, that first Sunday night, when the futures markets opened after the war started that weekend and gold briefly had a knee-jerk pop higher, I explained why you couldn't trust that. You were going to have to fade that, and you were going to have to expect that precious metals were going to go down. And in fact, here's a slide that I used in one or I think actually a couple of those presentations. And it's really very simple as to the reasons why this happened. And I'm going to get back and cover all of these later. And as I flesh out what the factors have to be that will be put in place for the next legs higher, first for gold and then afterward for silver, which I will 100% believe is coming sometime down the road. Not right away, regrettably. We're going to stay in this no man's land for a while and move around basically with the market as we've seen in the recent past. But here, there's three reasons why gold has been trending downward until the last several days when we've got these false hopes that the war is ending that has helped precious metals to rally and other metals to rally. At the same time, we've got new highs this last week as I'm recording this on Wall Street. I don't expect any of them to last very long, incidentally. That's one of the reasons why I'm still saying that we need to be cautious about this. But here again, three reasons. Number one, central banks, which were probably until the last year the single biggest tailwind for gold, particularly to go higher, they are now selling gold. Poland and Turkey, especially in a recent past, precious metals have been gobbled up, gold, predominantly by central banks for a while. I'm going to get into that whole thing of central banks in a few minutes. But these days, they have less money. They have less foreign exchange reserves that they haven't already allocated to gold based on what their designs are. And look, folks, especially in the other parts of the world, we are going to have a massive recession thanks to this war, thanks to the other trade issues still going on. And that is not the stuff of a bullish gold price. If you're expecting consumers to buy, they're going to be less flush. Central banks now are less flush. They pretty much have done a lot of the buying you're going to do. That's going to go away as a tailwind, right? Number two, the reason why, beyond that, and I think these were the two big ones that drove gold to well over $5,000 and for a while took the stock market a lot higher, as we saw last year. It's because the markets universally were expecting last year, and as we came into this year, aggressive further Federal Reserve easing, more lowering of interest rates, more printing of money. Well, we haven't gotten all of that. And I've been explaining the reasons for that for months now. And I've been vindicated on this. Some of you remember that at the end of last year, in a couple of podcasts I did my own and with some colleagues, I made the point that nobody for 2026 has on their bingo card the possibility that the Fed will raise short-term interest rates again. All of a sudden, that started to be discussed. And it was being discussed before the war with Iran started, and that's why precious metals were already weakening when the Iran war started and haven't gotten any better since. Because if now we've taken off the table for seemingly for the foreseeable future, the possibility the Fed is going to further ease monetary policy, you just removed another big tailwind that gold and later silver had over the last year or so, and that is an easier Fed. Now, I'll tell you later, as we get to the end of this podcast, that the Fed is not being as tight as they're putting on for public consumption. And in fact, we will see ultimately a situation unfold like late 2008, early 2009, when the Fed has no choice, whatever the inflation numbers are. And they're going higher again, not lower, as you all already have seen. The Fed will have no choice but to just hold its nose, tolerate higher inflation, because it's going to come down to what the late Richard Russell, the dean of newsletter writers, once said, it's all about inflate or die. And then number three, of course, a lot of the late money that came into gold and then silver, these were speculators. These were not gold bugs that came in. These were not silver bugs. Gold and silver bugs are invested 100% of their money, 100% of the time. I'm exaggerating, but to make the point, these were traders that came in. They were following momentum. And you've got a lot of money in the market that's brainless, that has no religion, that has no conscience, nothing. They're going to follow where the money is going. And for a while, the hot trade was gold and silver. All right. Well, another reason why gold has not responded, at least to any great extent, except the recent rally off the bottoms due to the war, is a lot of those same people looked at gold and silver. Hey, that's yesterday's news. I want to buy oil. I want to buy fertilizer stocks. I want to buy other things that are going to be in short supply and where you're going to be able to make short-term gains based on the war. Now, before we really get underway here, just a fairly brief crash commercial message, if I may be allowed. First of all, in the notes to this podcast, video and audio versions both, you will have a list of links that will take you to my website at the National Investor, to my YouTube channel, and to this podcast if you've not seen it directly on yourmoneytoday.org. Now, a number of companies that I have recommended prior in a National Investor support the messages that I put out. They like my approach. They like the fact that I'm more analytical. And frankly, if I may be allowed to say, I've got a better history of guiding people, especially in precious metals investments, than the precious metals gurus themselves, who, as I alluded to a while ago, never utter the word sell or cut back or anything like that, and are more religious than they are analytical. And frankly, a lot of them just don't understand the markets like you're going to understand these markets in about the next 45 minutes, give or take, after you've listened to or watched this podcast. So I encourage you to visit my sites. All of the companies that have supported the National Investor in one way or another and sponsoring this video and a couple others you're going to see coming up, you will find their video presentations, occasional updates, and so forth, most of all and most completely on my YouTube channel. In the very near future, we will finish a revamp of my podcast page, yourmoneytoday.org, where we will have a lot slicker looking profile pages for each of those companies. That's a work in progress that hopefully we'll be all done with by around the Memorial Day timeframe. So we're going to be updating all of that, making it look a lot sharper and up to date and so forth. Last but not least, of course, if in any way you are watching or listening to this and you are not presently on my mailing list, make sure you get on it. There's a free email list that I have that's very well followed. We've got about a 40% open rate on constant contact, which I'm always reminded by them, pretty much nobody has for people who aren't paying for the service, but get the information and like the information. So make sure you follow me on LinkedIn and Twitter and even Facebook as well. All of those links are here. And we don't ever put out stuff just for sake of putting it out. A lot of people who have followed me for a lot of years, and even those who haven't that much, look, I'm not always right, folks, but I'm an umpire. I call things as I see them. I don't get religious about any particular move, any particular recommendation. Not perfect. Sometimes I make mistakes. But the one thing I don't do is start with a preconceived notion. And you're going to learn that by the time, believe me, we're done with this exercise here right now. So generally what I'm going to do, and I've done this in various formats over the years, I'm going to try and keep it as succinct as possible, but I want to be detailed enough so that you get it. I want by the time this is done, if you are a gold bug who is in need, or silver bug as the case may be, of frankly some deprogramming, I want that job to be done for you by the time we're through here. If you're a generalist investor, who maybe knows a little bit about precious metals, but not a lot, I want to demystify the space for you. No, you don't need to wear a tinfoil hat to be a gold or silver bug or to believe that these are viable places to put your money. After all, if you go back to the modern day era of gold, which started in 1971 and had a spectacular restart in 1999, I'm going to tell you that story. It's the coolest story that I have ever covered and ever guided investors in 45 years of doing this. So you don't want to go away. And it's the one and only time that the Federal Reserve, as part of this story, actually did suppress the gold price. Bankers and market makers manipulate all markets every day. But one time, the Fed actually suppressed the gold price and was part of the second reboot of gold in a modern era. It's the coolest story you're ever going to hear if you're not familiar with it. And more details of that story I have links to as well with this video, with some archived stuff from the newsletter that I did back in that day, those versions of the National Investor, as well as a couple articles and so forth. You just don't want to miss this. It's a, not to belabor the cool, it's a cool story. But anyway, since 1971, after all that digression, since 1971, there has not been a better performing asset class you can find than gold. If you go back to that period of time, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has been multiplied by about 50-fold. The gold price, as of this last week, and I'm using round numbers, has more than tripled that return. So don't think that there's something wrong with you if you've been a gold investor over the years, because like a lot of assets, because of the long-term devaluation of the dollar, asset prices and other prices, regrettably, for the things that we buy every day, tend to go up because the volume of money and its value has gone down over the years. That's been, of course, the core story of gold all the time. So I'm going to take you through that history, talk about these different eras, if you will, of the modern day gold trade and why it's important to understand those. I'm going to talk about some general do's and don'ts as an investor, what you should do, what you shouldn't do, who and what you should stay away from, what you should embrace. I'm going to give you a lot of a roadmap as to how to do this. I am going to spend a little bit of time on silver because it is the junior precious metal. And when you have significant upward moves in gold, inevitably silver gets dragged along. But it is a different animal, and people need to realize that. I will be talking more about silver, particularly with other base metals, in another special podcast coming up in the very near future. It's going to be on my new Fangs theme. That's another cool story and another cool theme that we're going to talk about as far as commodities in a more general sense going forward. I suspect that most of you know or have heard of the first of two pivotal modern day dates for gold, the one being, of course, the first one in August 15th, 1971, when President Richard Nixon, the Treasury at the time, being faced with more demands from foreign governments and foreign investors for gold than the physical gold we had, basically, as history calls it, shut the gold window. He stopped the convertibility of U.S. paper assets of any kind, which by that time were pretty much things that were held by foreigners. He stopped the conversion of that into gold. He stopped redeemability and let the dollar again and gold become more free-floating in the marketplace. Part of that whole process, of course, was that he unleashed Arthur Burns on the world, who was the main Fed chairman for President Nixon. And between the two of them, they debauched the value of the US dollar. We had inflation and waves on and off in the 1970s. Uniquely back then, it was just the US, or predominantly the US, that was screwing up its national finances and its currency. Of course, since those days, we've got a global race to the bottom to see who can screw up their currencies the fastest and print money the fastest. It's this race to the bottom. And that's one of the reasons why, as I pointed out along the way, it's not as automatic today as it was in the 1970s that gold has to behave inversely to the US dollar. There are sometimes other factors. I mean, notably, during the earliest part of the war with Ukraine, gold did well along with the US dollar. More dramatically, back in the 2010, 2011 time frame, when the world didn't know if the euro was going to survive, the US dollar and gold screamed higher together for a while during that time. But back in the 70s, it was that more static inverse relationship. The value of the US dollar went down, US inflation rose, and gold had its first major secular move of the bull market that was unleashed in August of 1971, went going from the fixed price of $35 an ounce to a brief peak above $850 an ounce. A lot of you around at the time, I know I was, I enjoyed that. But then it all came to an end, thanks to chiefly Paul Volcker, who did not get rid of inflation in a monetary sense, but as I've explained many times, he shifted the inflation equation. And actually, when you look at money creation and debt, and I'm explaining this separately in a big presentation you're going to see shortly after this one, which is another one of my seminal works over the years called Understanding the Game. Paul Volcker kind of reordered the economic and monetary universe after he killed the price inflation of the 1970s and into 1980. He re-engineered the monetary and banking system, so it is a first matter, the much greater credit creation and monetary base expansion that started in the 80s and has only accelerated in all the years since then, did not, for the most part, as a first matter, go into the prices of goods and services. It went instead into asset prices. And when people saw this, they didn't understand it at the time, but most people didn't. But the fallout from this and the consequences of this basically was that even though inflation in a monetary sense accelerated under Volcker and then, of course, Greenspan and the others since then, that did not help gold. And we went from a peak of over $800 an ounce in 1980 for gold to what I called kind of being in the wilderness for 20 years nearly after that, where gold trended downward. It had occasional times where it blipped up. It was tradable. Good companies were still investable. But for 20 years, from the 80s to 1999, pretty much, we had a market where gold was in the wilderness because, by and large, the stock market was where all the action was. And that's where investors wanted to be. There were the occasional exceptions, but that was the broad landscape of things. In fact, I've pointed out many times the history of this. And again, I'll try and keep this short. A couple of the links I'll be adding will give you more background on this. But it was very true that in the 1980s and 90s, gold was not so much a manipulated market in a negative sense that we would look at that way today, but kind of like the way De Beers and the De Beers cartel controlled the diamond market. You didn't have a big liquid market for gold as you did for other things during that roughly 20-year stretch. And I still have in my possession a three full-page expose of the Financial Times that explained how this whole cartel worked with gold. You had George Bush Sr., you had Brian Mulroney, the former Prime Minister of Canada. You had Republic Bank of New York, you had a couple of the other big banks, and you had Barrick Gold, which some of you who are old enough to remember this was the company that gold bugs loved to hate because they hated the fact that Barrick was making deals to forward sell their gold, and that was one of the things keeping a lid on the market. So those players and a few other hangers-on pretty much managed the gold price for the better part of 20 years, having as much influence as market activities over gold. Now, that De Beers cartel-like management of those players I mentioned of the gold price came to an abrupt end and a very unexpected and sudden one on most people's parts at the second date that gold bugs who are informed should remember from history as big or bigger as August 15th, 1971. That date was September 26, 1999. And I'm going to build this up a little bit. I'm going to again try and keep this short for some other links, but this is a great story. And again, it's one of the best ones you'll ever hear of what happened along the way in the secular bull market for gold that started back at that first date in 1971. As I alluded to, where Barrick was concerned, there were other players, other central banks that during the 80s and 90s, especially as we got into the 90s, gold was old-fashioned. It was a barbarous relic, as Warren Buffett and others famously called it. Didn't pay any interest. Who needs gold anymore? We've got modern money mechanics. We've got the Fed. We've got derivatives. We've got soaring asset valuations on Wall Street and all the rest. And it wasn't fashionable anymore, or practical for a lot of these modern central bankers, treasury officials, and so forth to continue to hang on to gold. The problem was during those years that nobody knew when people were going to sell. And so inevitably, this happened time and time again. You had a situation where gold would get a little bit of a life, you'd have a good run. And look, there were times during the 80s and 90s that, gold rallied fairly considerably when inflation flared up. There were worries about the budget deficit rising and so forth. And boom, here's the latest central bank announcing we're selling 200 tons or we're selling this or that and pull the rug out from under everybody. And it got tiresome. Some people were smart enough to trade that. And especially when in the latter part of the 90s, and this is one of the infamous gold stories of mismanagement of national reserves ever, Gordon Brown, Chancellor of the Exchequer in the UK, famously marked what was called later Brown's Bottom. He sold all of the UK's gold at the bottom of the market in the late 90s. And not only did he do that, but incredibly, and for those of us who were, followed this, it was a good cash register for a while, investment-wise. They sold 25 tons of gold at regular intervals that were they told you ahead of time when they were going to sell it. So everybody and their dog and the fleas on the dog knew when this gold was going to be sold. And it was, I think, every 6 weeks, every 2 months, something like that. So what happened was traders, looking at the other factors, whether gold was bullish or bearish at that particular time, aside from the UK gold sale and whatever else might be coming along, you would sometimes be able to trade these sales and buy at the bottom, sell after an auction, and the market had taken up that gold and it did a good job. The gold price might rally, and I, in those days, in a national investor, would have occasions where I would have our subscribers buy call options on the major mining stocks. Back then, it was companies like Newmont and Barrick, Placer Dome, which is long gone, Getchell Gold, which is more long gone. There is a new Getchell Gold today, if you didn't know, but I'm talking about the old one. Homestake Mining, which Barrick bought afterward, and so forth. And this was easy money. Now, in September, earlier in the month, in September of 1999, I had given people those same instructions again. And sure enough, the auction take-up was good later in the month of September. And the gold price was rallying. We got in at like 260 as a share was the gold price. And the gold price was ticking up, to 290, 300 and thereabouts. And so again, initially on the surface, just another successful trade based on these very well telegraphed auctions by Gordon Brown. But what nobody knew was coming happened as a side note of the World Bank meeting in New York later that month. And on September 26, 1999, what was called the Central Bank Gold Agreement was announced. The scandal in the industry, in the gold industry, and with the manipulation of the gold price back then, what I mean is, central banks coming out, selling it, et cetera. That was not doing the gold industry a whole hell of a lot of good. And one of the talking points at the World Bank meeting that month was that a lot of miners in Africa and other countries that were gold producers were losing their jobs because the companies couldn't stay open. Who knows what the price of your commodity is going to be? And if you don't have any certainty, you're not going to mine as much. You're not going to employ as many people, et cetera. So that was one of the reasons why this gold agreement came out. And it set a lid that all the central banks, with the notable exception of the Federal Reserve, everybody else said, okay, we're going to cap our sales of and or leasing activities of gold at X every year henceforth. That took away the biggest sword of Damocles that had been over the gold market for years. And when that news came out, what was already a rally in gold price started to accelerate and go higher. It got up to $340 two different times. After the first time it did, it got slammed back down. It started to run up again. I got on the phone to a good friend and contact of mine at that time, long since passed away. He was a Democrat. He was the lawyer for the Democrat side of the House Banking Committee. He and I were regular cocktail hour companions when I was back and forth in Washington in those days. And I asked him, I said, don't tell me anything that's too out of school, but you got your finger on the pulse. Is it the Fed and Republic Bank that is pushing the gold price down? He said, yes. So the second time it got up to 340, I told everybody to sell our call options that we had, and we made a lot of money. And sure enough, that was the end of that. And gold ended up going back to 250 to 260, had a second bottom at that level in 2001 before it went up. Why did that happen? It happened because everybody was offside, and the Fed had to come to the rescue of people who shorted gold again at the end of the first part of that move too quickly. Now they were all underwater, and big names, big players, a lot of money. So the Federal Reserve, not a party to the agreement and needing to help bail out people anyway, forced the price of gold back down so everybody can get out of harm's way. The incredible irony and the finish of that particular story is of the Fed involvement. Of course, the guy who was behind this was Alan Greenspan, who was the Fed chairman. Who was the Fed chairman later on in 2003 after we had had a major deflation scare because of the bull market and the recession, made worse by 9/11 and 2001 and 2? Everybody thought we were going to go the route of Japan and deflation was going to take hold. Gold was still on its back and everything like that. But finally, Greenspan was pumping things higher enough, lowering interest rates, cheapening the dollar, increasing the money supply. And the next time, as a part of that whole thing, that gold hit 340 and kept going, he was its biggest cheerleader because he said, "Look, I told you I was going to lick deflation. I told you we weren't going the way of Japan. The gold price is ratifying my strategy." So here again, it depends on which side of the trade the big boys are or are not on. But again, a cool story. And that took away, again, the biggest negative factor. And over the years, and more so as it accelerated in a more recent 10 or 12 years, central banks, the net selling that was still going on by central banks started to diminish. And then in more recent years, central banks became major net buyers of gold, especially in the last handful of years when it became voracious. And I think a lot of the talk about there's going to be a new gold-backed BRICS currency or something like that. The charlatans talking about that are always talking about a new IMF currency. When Biden was president, some of these same people were telling you that he was going to take your money and you were going to get a Biden bucks digital currency in return. That's all crap. But the bottom line is that the central banks believe in gold. They don't believe in the dollar anymore. Frankly, right now with this war, Donald Trump has been driving people away, just like Joe Biden did with sanctions. So we are going to see the process continue. But for the time being, the U.S. dollar is still the globe's reserve currency. That's a subject for another day. But it's diminishing in value along with all the other ones, and gold is going to continue to do well. And that's why central banks, until just very recently, have been very strong net buyers. Now, while the central bank demand for gold on net it had a fairly steady trajectory from being net sellers after the central bank gold agreement still for some time, but that was diminishing, to being more aggressive net buyers over time, that has tailed off recently. However, for again reasons I alluded to earlier, the investment demand, which is the other biggie, really, aside from jewelry and fabrication demand, the demand as far as investors are concerned, is a lot more fickle over time. And again, and I use these figures once in a while to show how stark the change is. Of course, the markets have changed. Our world has changed. Financial products and services have changed. There are now more ETFs, exchange traded funds on Wall Street, than there are underlying stocks, for crying out loud. I mean, there's been all of this financial engineering to keep this whole skyscraper of cards in our fiat money, fractional reserve system, keep it all from imploding, that has taken a lot of the attention away from gold and other really hard assets and commodities. Everything is all about stocks and real estate and this stuff that is, in comparison, getting goosed the most and the most necessarily by either the monetary or fiscal authorities. And again, not just in the US anymore, but pretty much the world over. Back at the peak in 1980, if you take all of the mining stocks in the S&P 500 and all of the energy stocks in the S&P 500, the two of them combined were about a third of the overall stock market valuation in those days. Astonishing. Recently, after the monster runs in gold, and even with the recent, move higher in oil prices, largely because of the war, those numbers are a fraction of the overall market. I mean, energy stocks in the S&P 500 before the war were like 3%, which is silly. One of the reasons why I, even notwithstanding the war, I thought that energy stocks, generally speaking, were still undervalued compared to everything else. The gold sector, you darn near need a microscope to look at it. And even the other mining stocks, you throw them in, you're still only another few percent, because AI and everything else, the Mag 7, the old fangs and everything else has kind of taken all the oxygen out of the room, and of course all the money with it. So this is why it's important when I do these tutorials to get gold bugs, especially those of you that are out there that need to be deprogrammed, to realize that the rest of the world doesn't see things as you do. And look, I tell people all the time, including my fellow gold bugs, I'm probably more of a religious gold bug and sure as hell more of a rabid anti-Fed and anti-establishment person than you are when it comes to money and the right way to use money and the right kind of a monetary system we should have and all the rest. But as a practical matter, you got to understand that in these days, 99% of the other investors don't see things like you do. So you're pretty damn lonely if you're out there riding, the portfolio of gold and silver and other related stocks for all these years, wondering why you're not making money. Well, as a teenager would say, duh. You got to have other people that believe in what you do, that after you start, that type of investing, they're going to help validate it by agreeing with you eventually. And that's what you got to look at along the way, folks, and especially now. And this is what I tried to explain to people recently with the war. Now, the best example I can give historically of how, and this happened to some extent in the last year or so as well. But if you go back to 2008, we all remember 2008, what happened? Everything crashed. The banking system was coming unhinged. Everybody went out over their skis with subprime mortgages and the real estate market and all the rest of that stuff. And I don't care what it was, everything went down, because when you have shocks in the market and when you have deflation actually evidencing itself, and by deflation, I mean all of the inflating of asset prices and debt has to come down. That's math, and it's the laws of economics. I don't care what it is, everything comes down. And gold, which had just touched $1,000 not long before the crash for the very first time ever, ended up crashing down, I think it was $670 was the bottom not long after the crash. But it rallied before other things did, and the best times really since 2000 for people to invest in precious metals were from 2009 to the early part of 2011. The reason for that was that in response to the crash, the Fed had to print lots of money. They introduced quantitative easing to the world. We learned what helicopter Ben Bernanke was all about. Interest rates went to nothing, et cetera. And the economy and the markets and other asset classes were so badly broken and took so long for all of this monetary tonic to get everything else up off the mat, that markets and investors who really weren't gold bugs prior to that rightly looked at this situation and said, hey, if the Fed is printing all this money, but it's not going to have any impact for a while on these other areas, it's only going to feed to more currency devaluation and eventually more inflation. And that's why from 2009 through early 2011, you had a monster run in precious metals and precious metal stocks. I was telling people at the beginning of 2011 to drastically reduce our allocation to the precious metal stocks. Gold itself didn't peak until later in the year. But folks, this is a lesson that some of you learned the hard way. If you go back to that peak of the precious metal stocks in early 2011 and you didn't sell and you rode that, and looking at just the broad sector, by the ETFs, and here's an example. It was last year, as gold was going up through 3,000 and then 4,000, as opposed to peaking a little less than two back then. It took until last year for you to break even on those stocks you held for 14 years. Okay, and that was because why? It was because the generalist investors that came in properly so and realized that the precious metals and precious metal stocks were going to be the best game in town in the immediate aftermath of the crash in 2008. Those people started selling when helicopter Ben's QE and other magic started to work, and the stock market was regaining its momentum, Real estate was going back up, and other things were. And what do those other people do that aren't religious about gold? They sold, as they should have done, and as we did to a great extent back then. And instead of riding it all those years since. Now, over time, there are individual companies that I look more at the story than about trying to time the gold swings and even the swings of the broad precious metal stocks. But generally speaking, this is a great lesson and one that a lot of people out there learn the hard way, that you don't sit with huge allocations when the market is going to turn against you, as it did after that time. Now, we did see more of this kind of broadening of investment demand come in the more recent past. Why was that? Well, if you go back to 2000, and I've told this story many times, before COVID gave current Fed Chair Jerome Powell, who's still Fed Chair for a little while longer, depending on how the political jockeying goes in Washington and the whole investigation of him and so forth, I've been covering elsewhere. Jerome Powell, with COVID, he wasn't helicopter Jay, he was cargo plane Jay, as I show here. And in fact, he was starting to have to print a lot of money because there were new stresses. A lot of the cleaning out of speculation that should have happened after 2008 was thwarted by Bernanke and quantitative easing and printing more money and just papering over all this stuff while debt levels continued to go up and debt quality went down. Well, now we're in a different world. And that's because, first off, in 2019, Jerome Powell, in the fall before COVID even came about, was already shoveling money into the overnight repo markets and so forth. He famously said, the euphemism at the time was he discovered a plumbing problem in the banking system, the same kind of plumbing problem he's shoveling money into as we speak right now, if you haven't been paying attention to that. And then when COVID came about, he had carte blanche to print all kinds of money. The Trump and then the Biden administration afterwards had all kinds of fiscal measures to add trillions in debt. Not productive uses. We didn't get anything for it except more debt. And so, for the first time since the 1970s, there was such massive monetary creation that now inflation was not just in asset prices. Now it's consumer prices again. Now it's producer prices again. We had a couple of runs in the last few years with double-digit price inflation that we hadn't seen since the 1970s and into 1980. And that, of course, is what started to get a lot more people turned on to gold again. Interestingly, even through the recent past, as I've observed this and compared notes with colleagues and others, this has not still been a big retail-driven mania. All right. You've got a lot of family offices, a lot of big investment houses that have been aggressive investors in gold. I've used as an example, for instance, the annual conference I go to in New Orleans. Many of you are familiar with it, the New Orleans Investment Conference. And last year, for the first time in many years, the attendance was over 1,000. And notably, it was not garden variety retail gold bug investors who, in any case, and I've already said this, they're already up to their eyeballs and in gold and silver and in stocks, and they're 100% invested 100% of the time. They're there to hear their favorite rock stars and conspiracy theories or whatever. But the added increase in the attendance last year was notably of much more sophisticated family offices, investment funds, other people like that, and wealthier individual investors who were very clearly there with their sleeves rolled up to figure out, okay, I get it now. I believe in this now. I'm here to figure out what to do with my money, what kind of a shopping list I should have. So we've seen some evidence again of this investment demand starting to broaden out. It got hit because of the war and because of the outlook on the Fed and so forth, but it will come back. Now, beyond that garden variety view of more people getting back into the gold space and finally gold equities that perked up in a big way in the last year, year and a half, they've given back some of their gains. And to me, that's a time, as I'll get to again in a minute, to be if you took some money off the table, as I advise, you're going to want to start loading back up again. Look at some other good stories out there, and I'm going to give you the attributes to look for in a minute. But generally speaking, still with gold, beyond that garden variety inflation thing, this is getting more urgent with the world's monetary systems and with the global debt overhang that is now getting to the place where not only is the debt completely unpayable, but it's unserviceable as time is going on. It's just that far out of hand. And so some of you possibly have heard the term in the recent past that gold has become a debasement trade. And that means currencies will debase more aggressively, more overtly, because central banks led by the Federal Reserve basically have no choice. Governments are so far in over their head, they don't know anything else to do. But, they keep digging. The hole's getting deeper. They keep digging, and that is putting more stress in credit markets. President Trump, of course, notably has been very antagonistic to Jerome Powell. If Kevin Warsh or Paul Volcker or Alan Greenspan or anybody else was alive today doing the same thing, he'd have the same attitude. He wants interest rates down to nothing. But when you are adding debt at a $2 trillion a year plus clip, that's not the stuff of lower interest rates. For the first time since really the 70s and into 1980 and so forth, you're hearing more and more the term the bond market vigilantes. And there's a reason why interest rates have stayed stubbornly high. It's because inflation is remaining stubbornly high. Folks, you may have missed this with all of the other news out there, but we're at a 3 to 4% annualized inflation clip with consumer prices and producer prices, not the 2 to 3% that the markets thought we were going to have. And it's getting worse rather than better. The Fed can't lower interest rates on a surface, at least in an environment like that. But the cracks are nevertheless appearing underneath the surface. As I alluded to a few minutes ago, the Fed is having to be more and more aggressive these days and plowing money into repo markets and in trying to shore up the cracks and fill the cracks that are coming. Jerome Powell's got himself another plumbing problem, folks. It's not going to get better. And this war is going to make things worse with a weaker economy, even less able to service all this gargantuan debt out there. And where the federal government is concerned, Donald Trump has claimed that he's the king of debt. He sure as hell is. Last year when he got his one big, beautiful baseball, hot dogs, apple pie, the flag, and Motherhood MAGA bill passed through Congress, what a lot of people forgot about is that the base case of that legislation added 20 trillion more in debt over the next decade. This didn't balance a damn thing. It didn't reduce the deficits, all else being equal. And now they're going to be worse, of course, because of all the money Trump wants to wage war in different parts of the world, or to reconquer or conquer anew our own hemisphere, whether it's Venezuela, Cuba, Greenland, or whoever might come next. So this is all the reason why, on top of the Fed chairs, who over the years have been great at debauching the currency. This is one of my favorite graphics to use. You had the, and again, this is kind of the base case for gold as well as a lot of other assets. Years ago, a century or so, you had the famous Murderers Row, the New York Yankees lineup. Today, you've got the Murderers Row of the Fed chairs that we've had in the last 30 or 40 years that have done nothing but add to that. And whatever they tell you the contrary, the Fed being independent, blah, blah, blah. The Fed as a central bank has enabled government debt. If they did things the way we used to do it, the government would spend within its means because the market would force it. The Fed has enabled all of this by adding to its balance sheet, buying a lot of the debt as the buyer of last resource, and that's only going to get worse. And again, that's all part of the debasement trade. It started, those of you who have followed me regularly know that this started in earnest about a year ago with Japan starting to unwind from years of its own financial repression. Now interest rates are soaring in Japan relative to the base bargain basement and even negative levels they were at not all that long ago. And when those things happen, other things unwind. So ultimately, the way the governments and the central banks are necessarily going to respond to this, including the Fed, which right now has no choice. It's got its hands tied, and they're honest about that. The Fed can't really cut interest rates now with inflation going back up and likely to go up further. But they're scared to death now, at least, to raise them either into a supply shock. over oil and fertilizer and a lot of other things that are going to be in shorter supply because of this war. But inevitably, the debt situation and the economic deterioration will force their hand. And as you see here from one of the more recent cartoons that my great cartoonist of many years, Jerry King, did at my BS, I can't draw a stick figure, folks, but I can come up with pretty corny or sometimes pithy ideas, and he makes a cartoon for me. So this is where Jerome Powell is stuck right now. The bond market vigilantes, if the Fed were to respond to Trump and cut rates now, long-term rates would really go skyrocketing because that would be the final signal. And it's coming. But for the time being, the Fed's getting away with maintaining the status quo so as to keep the bond market at bay. So to satisfy the bond vigilantes, the Fed really can't cut interest rates. But at the same time, we've got this looming credit crisis where frankly, is a matter of math and gravity overdue for another 2008, or at least a version of it that might be, not be as abrupt and sharp, but be more of a slow, dull ache rather than that quick, violent pain. That's looming out there, and inevitably, there is zero question, as things stand right now, that the Fed, when it has to choose its manner of comeuppance, is going to choose the Grim Reaper here and his scythe. And say the bond market vigilantes, okay, well, I can only satisfy one of you, and it's going to be inflate or die. And that's the point, kind of like in 2009, when you will see a broader takeoff again and a next big secular move where gold and silver is concerned. But for the time being, we're going to kind of be in this no man's land. Now, as we're into the downhill side here, of course, in this lengthy podcast, but necessarily lengthy, I want to, as I promised, give a shout out to silver and give a few highlights of how I view that junior precious metal. Again, in the near future, when I do my new fangs broader commodities presentation, I'll spend more time on it. But first of all, as far as silver is concerned, and I always have to tell this to people who are is rah-rah or more so on silver, and again, it's kind of a manner of seems almost religion for some people. But the first thing I'll point out is that of all of the banks for quite a few years now that have been accumulating gold aggressively as a reserve asset, name me one that in any way, let alone any significant way, has been accumulating silver for the same reason. Can't find any. It's not the monetary reserve asset that central banks use. So that's number one. Secondly, silver typically is viewed by the markets and by everybody who is not a religious silver bug as more of an industrial metal than it is a precious metal. And that's why, by and large, with little exception for years, you will see silver behave more in line, and I'm generalizing to make this broader point, with copper, nickel, other metals and industrial metals and commodities more so than with gold. It's why you've seen gold hold up better. It's why when we have times that there's not a lot of fear of deflation and we've got a broad acceleration of the economy and so forth, there are times that silver has outperformed gold. And I think will again at some point down the road. But early on, if you put a gun to my head and say, what does Chris Temple like more in April of 2026, gold or silver? My answer is very definitely gold, even though I think we're going to have to wait for that Fed latest epiphany that they've got to print more money before we get to the old highs and go higher. And look, we're going to go higher long term for the same reasons that we've gone from $35 to 5,000 or so, give or take. And that's because of what the Fed does. It's because of what governments do with debt. That's not going to change. It's not going to go away. So we will see higher prices, but the markets won't embrace that until the Fed has to panic and start printing money again. And we're not there yet, not quite yet. I think it'll be months rather than years. Quite likely, but we're not there yet. Silver has got a couple of unique things going for it, though, that I want to point out. And a couple of these are pretty darn counterintuitive, even from what I just said. Consider that one of the themes, as silver was spiking belatedly and caught up with gold and then was screaming higher for a while, until it just got stupid when we were well over $100 an ounce. And I mean, that was an accident waiting to happen. Okay, we would get too much speculation, too many people offside, and everybody on the same side of the boat, kind of a thing. But a lot of that was on a legitimate view, and this is common with a lot of the other metals out there. I've talked about this in the context of uranium, of copper, of zinc, and others. When you extrapolate the necessary supply that the world needs of all of these different metals, you go ahead 10 or 20 years, it ain't there. There's supply shortfalls of all of these things, including of silver. So that is going to be one of the things that undergirds silver's long-term picture quite a bit. The other thing to keep in mind right now is that once gold gets moving again, it will drag silver along. I'm not completely dismissing silver's behavior with gold as a precious metal that will respond to inflation. And we saw this in that earlier example I referred to from 2009 to 2011. Silver was dragged along by gold and then was moving up nicely in its own right, got up to a pretty nice level in 2011. And that was while a lot of the other base metals weren't doing all that hot because of the still lingering broad economic problems that we have. So it will happen. Perhaps we'll see silver back down to where it broke out at 50 to 55 before it bottoms and it's going to be safe to get in again. I don't know right now. I'm ambivalent, honestly, on a near-term direction. And I even think, as I do with the stock market, and I'll throw this out there to more date this presentation. I don't trust the rallies in recent days in gold and silver any more than I do the rally to record highs for stocks in this last several days for all the same reasons. And I'll be talking about those separately in the days ahead as necessary. But a thing that I really am salivating over, and this sounds dopey perhaps, where silver is concerned, is that if with the likelihood of an onset of a global recession, it'll be worse in some places than others. I mean, it's already getting to be an acute problem in Asia and Europe because of a lot of supplies of energy and fertilizer and sulfur and all these other things that aren't getting through. They're going to fare worse in relative terms probably than we are in this part of the world, but it's still going to hurt. When you see that kind of a thing happen, when you see deflation start to, get a whiff of credit markets starting to unwind, so I'm talking about deflation in that sense, that means that there will be even less mining of a lot of base metals that we need. And given the fact that silver is still a major byproduct of a lot of base metal production, that means it's a supply situation for silver will grow more acute as far as the supply and demand imbalance it will be in silver's long-term favor. So look, silver is needed for a lot of things. Renewable energy, I mean, 30% of all the new of silver demand goes to solar alone, and that's growing worldwide. And in the right context, I believe in silver, or in solar rather, and some of these other renewable energies, if it's in the right context and the economics work and the climate is right and so forth. And silver's got a lot of needs. I mean, electronics, you hear a lot about copper's need for AI and electronics and stuff. Silver, too. A lot of other metals are needed for these things. So, look, the long-term picture for silver is every bit as bullish as for gold. But again, you got to keep in the back of your mind it's for different reasons, and they aren't always going to act together in unison. That said, there are times, as with gold, where I'm bullish sector-wide. And now I want to go, as we finish winding down, into the specific do's and don'ts of how you invest in these areas, and just a few more quick timing ideas before we close. Again, to keep up with things like this from time to time that I put out, make sure that you're following me in one or preferably multiple ways, not only at my email list, but also on social media, YouTube, yourmoneytoday.org, my podcast channel, and of course at nationalinvestor.com if you want access to all of my information on asset allocation and how to rejigger things as necessary, and all the different individual companies I recommend and whatnot. You can sign up and be a member. And right now, we've got a special offer, as you'll see when you get there. So you go to the National Investors website, click on subscribe or renew, and follow the yellow brick road. Now, real quick, I want to talk about some of the things that you should avoid when it comes to precious metals. As I commented earlier on, a lot of services are out there and a lot of gurus are out there who follow nothing but precious metals. Some specialize even just in silver. So they're not going to be bearish on it. So you've got to be careful where you're getting your information from. Make sure it's balanced, make sure it makes sense. Obviously, part of this whole exercise is to show you my wares and a sensible way to approach these things as an investor without with the religion put on the shelf, and realizing that there are times that you have a heavy weighting and times you have to reduce that, and then what circumstances you need to load up again, etc. So you've got to make sure you're getting credible information. Some of the bad information that's out there reveals itself, I mean, just starkly. Here's a few examples I'll run through as I'm saying this, but I've always found it comical over the years. And look, I've got a lot of people who do precious metal services and newsletters and shows who have been friends and colleagues for a long, long, long time. I'm not trying to pick on any one person. And again, I'm not always right in my individual calls either. But you want to be right most of the time, and especially, and you're right most of the time when you don't let your preconceived notions of how things should be get in the way of how things really are when you've got to deal in the kind of markets that we have today. That's just common sense. So, the people put out the kind of stuff that I just rolled through a few examples up here. Don't walk away, run. You don't want to do that. That's number one. Number two, when it comes to investing in physical metals, which a lot of people have done. I mean, it's been astonishing that even without a lot of retail interest still in precious metal stocks and mutual funds and that kind of thing, as there should be with these kind of prices, it's been interesting to see that a lot of retail investors have bought a lot of physical metals. You've probably all heard of, maybe even experienced, even a company like Costco, which was selling physical precious metals. They were running out. They can't keep it on a shelf. It used to be easy and cheap to buy gold and silver coins, just regular everyday bullion. It's become more expensive, a little harder to come by for that. But when you do that, make sure you have it in your hands, because the chief reason why you would buy physical gold and silver bullion is to have on hand, frankly, is mad money. If we have a wilderness economy, the economy blows a major gasket, some foreign country that's had enough of U.S. imperialism detonates an EMP device, and we don't have, all of our computers are fried. We don't have bank accounts, gas pumps that work, cash registers that work. Nothing's moving, no logistics, no nothing, because we're all dependent on computerization. We're all dependent on the power grid. That's why you buy physical gold and silver. Don't buy it in places where you don't get delivery. That's my personal preference, and that's my advice. And when you're looking at physical gold and silver, do not, under any circumstances, buy so-called rare coins or collectibles as a means to have that to barter with. That's just idiotic. A lot of people promoted it for that reason over the years because there's huge hidden commissions in the valuations of these rare coins. Another thing to avoid, and I was glad to see Tucker Carlson come out recently with a big expose of this, but I've warned people for years that the worst thing to do with your tax-qualified IRA money is to buy one of these so-called gold IRAs. It's not very bright, in my view, to take an asset that you can hold anonymously, physical precious metals, and put them into an IRA account that's not anonymous anymore, number one. Secondly, in most instances, you can't have it in your hands. All right, that's started to change a little bit. The other thing is that there's only certain categories of coins that you can buy in a precious metals IRA, and they are considerably more expensive than run-of-the-mill bullion coins are concerned. So don't ever put your IRA money into physical precious metals. You want something that's typically taxable and isn't going to be anonymous in that. And I guess the other thing before I get into the to-do list, as far as more proactive investing, is again, be sure, and maybe I'm being a little bit redundant here, but I want to drive the point home. Be sure that your allocation to precious metals in all forms is sensible. It's not overly too much when the market's going to go against you, and there's signs of that, or it's not too little. I mean, I'll use again the example of 2009 to 2011. We had 40% of an overall portfolio at the peak in 2011 was in precious metals, stocks, and ETFs. We cut that in half in January of 2011, and by the end of the year, we were from 40% down about 10 or 12% when you added up everything. We were totally out of the ETFs, cut back on a lot of the individual stocks. And a lot of times what I'll do, folks, and those of you who are members have seen me do this a lot in the recent past, when we've gone from what was last year, when you add up precious metals, base metals, even uranium, I'm going to throw all these commodities in one pot. If you go to the middle of 2025 or thereabouts, we had something like 60% of an overall recommended portfolio in those areas. Now we're down to around 20 in a recent past, and that was selling parts of a lot of companies that we had 3x, 5x, or thereabouts. I never completely recommend getting out of a company if I still like the story long term. But if it's obvious to me that it's going to go, and I won't mention a name, but one stock in like 18 months' time went from $1 to $12 back to $4. We sold a fair bit of it around 9 or 10 in that area when you average it out. We've still got a good position in it, and pretty soon we'll be reloading. That's how you do these things. Because any idiot can make money when these things are going up. But what separates a successful investors in the markets overall, let alone in sectors like precious metals that notoriously have huge swings up and down, as money comes in and then money leaves, the more important thing to do than make money in a rising market is to hang on to it and not suffer losses when it goes down. Now, let's get into the things to do proactively and how I look at the checklist of things when it comes to investing in precious metals overall. A lot of the things I'm going to share with you right now, some people are going to embrace certain areas better than others. A lot of it is based on your comfort level with precious metals. A lot of it is based on your knowledge and past history of these things. So I'm just going to give you a quick list of the types of investments that you should be considering. And then when it comes to individual companies, a checklist that I think is pretty reasonable to use to judge the better opportunities. Because when all is said and done, my favorite way to invest in precious metals is to find those individual companies. Sometimes exploration companies leaning that way, but in these recent times, there's been some killer companies that have done great in the market. I mean, you would think they were a junior stock with as much as they've gone up, and it's because they're producing now at $5,000 an ounce gold instead of 2,000 an ounce gold. So companies that have got, and I've got a couple of them on my recommended list that you'll see recent updates on my YouTube page. I mean, man, you're going from decent cash flow to swimming in money and enabling a lot of other good stuff for some of these companies. So make sure you check out those companies. And again, I'll get into a list of that. But first of all, the simple way that a lot of people look at precious metals, aside from buying physical gold and silver, which I don't ever stress a whole lot. I mean, I think it's a good idea, as I alluded to earlier, to have some physical gold and silver. Only buy bullion. Don't buy the rare coins, don't buy the proofs and all that kind of stuff. It's not what it's for. If you're looking at silver and gold as a crisis hedge, you want to be able to barter with it. But again, you don't even need to go overboard on that. I used to tell people at the Y2K circuit I was on back in the late 90s when we were all obsessed over how much Y2K was or wasn't going to hurt things. And I would sometimes get into friendly arguments, even on stage panels in front of audiences with some of the guys that were there that were only selling precious metals. And I would say to them, look, I'll make a deal with you. You stock up on gold and silver coins. I'll stock up on tobacco and whiskey. And if everything goes to hell in a handcart because of Y2K, we'll see who can barter the easiest. And I'll bet you it's me. So gold and silver are good, but they aren't a be all and end all. It's a little tougher and more expensive these days to buy precious metals than it was before we had these big runs, but it's still possible. There's still some good firms out there that I trust that'll treat you right. If you need a referral, let me know and I'll turn you on to the best sources I have. I don't have an axe to grind, I don't get paid by any of them, but people and firms that I know and have known for years. Next we have for people who like gold and silver but don't trust stocks, they just want a proxy for gold or silver. You've got ETFs out there. Exchange traded funds, and here's a list of the major ones that are out there. I prefer the either the DGP or the UGL ETFs on this list. If your timing is right, there's more leverage with these ETFs than there is with IAU or GLD, for example. It's just a flat unleveraged proxy for the gold price. And from time to time, I haven't done it recently. I kind of wish I had at the recent peaks in retrospect, but I'm always pining to find Dr. Emmett Brown and borrow his DeLorean so I can go back and make moves that I should have done and didn't, or vice versa from time to time. But if you're really convinced that gold is going to go down, there's ways you can use ETFs to short the gold price. And that's a possibility. I sure wouldn't be want to be doing it at this particular point, because I do think that the long-term trend still is up. And if you didn't already short gold when it got up to its recent peak and now it's down and we're going to kind of chop around for a while, in my view, it's too late to do that, even if I don't think we're going to see higher prices right away. Moving along, if you understand and believe that with broader moves in the gold price or silver price, as the case may be, and I put the silver bullion ETFs on here as well, that I just showed you. If you think that either gold or silver is going to do well enough that the gold stocks as a group are going to go up, and you'd rather use the ETFs as a default. Of course, the GDX and a GDXJ, there's a lot of overlap in those these days. Are the best known proxies and the best used proxies. They've come up to billions of dollars of valuations now because there's enough money and enough activity in them. The GDXJ on a surface is the more junior oriented companies, but again, there's a lot of overlap in them. But the mix is a little bit more of the smaller companies in the GDXJ. And if you're really aggressive, and I've used this as a trading vehicle from time to time, you think you're going to get an especially good pop, you've got Nugget, which is the Direxion uber leveraged gold stock ETF. But you better have good timing on it because you'll get your head handed to you if you don't. That's the time you want to use its opposite number, Dust. And we used that a few years ago, and I thought there was going to be a good decline in gold. We made a little bit of money on it. And that's how you can have a leveraged bet against gold stocks, that gold stocks are going to decline. But again, I think it's a little bit too late to do that right now. A lot of investors are comfortable to just use ETFs, and whether it's to put 5% of your portfolio in it because you think that's prudent and just kind of ride it for a long time, whether it's to move in and out, that's fine. I do things a little bit differently. I use, as a first matter, individual stocks I like for the long term based on their fundamentals. And I categorize stocks on my recommended list, folks, by ones that are more solid, relatively speaking, at least growth-oriented ones that have got, lots of cash, good resource base already, even if they're not producing. And then there's speculative ones that have still got a few hoops to jump through to prove up a resource and to get more attention and so forth. The market has still, and I've alluded to this a couple of times along the way, not been as hot as you should have, a lot of people expected to see for gold stocks overall, let alone a lot of individual companies. But there's enough new attention that has come in the last couple of years or so, for the reasons I articulated a little bit ago, that the companies that deserve it are getting the attention and getting investors taking positions. And that's it's a healthier environment that I've seen in a long time, even though, as a group, you can argue that gold and silver stocks, and I do argue this, are still some of them asinine as far as how cheap they are compared to the metal prices. But again, this is the fickle nature of that other 99% of investors out there. You've got to understand the things that are going to be necessary to get them re-engaged once again. And that's coming. And again, I think it's going to be more so months, or rather than a number of years before that happens. But when it comes to individual stocks, it's one of the more enjoyable things I've done in all industries, including mining over the years, is to visit lots of different companies. The introductory part of my standard YouTube videos oftentimes has a montage of a lot of these different kind of visits and companies over the years. They're biotech, they're different industries, they're mining, they're whatever the case may be. Base metals as well as precious metals. And it's fun to be able to kick the tires because I love what Warren Buffett, John Templeton, the late John Templeton, and others have said for years. And even though the passive investing regimen today has kind of overwhelmed traditional bottom-up stock picking, it's still there, folks. And if you make good calls, it's still rewarding. And so I first start when it comes to building a portfolio and an allocation for people with individual companies. When I like the sector overall, I add. So I kind of do it backwards from what a lot of people do, quite honestly. I'll add additional exposure with the GDXJ, with a Nugget, with an SILJ for silver stocks, and that kind of thing. That's how I'll build a greater position. We're totally out right now of any of the ETFs. And again, we've reduced a lot of our individual stock positions, but I'm adding a few new companies right now, and I'm starting to make the case for people to start nibbling back and get bigger positions anew in stocks like the one I referred to a minute ago, where we sold a lot of it at 9 or 10. Now it's corrected down to 4. Okay, that's too cheap again. So nibble, nibble at that somewhat. So how do you judge what kind of a company you should look at? Here's a quick checklist. First and foremost, when it comes to management, I love what I've often called my betting on the jockey theme. There's a lot of good people in this industry, which is actually very close-knit. I've been astonished, and as I'm recording this, actually, I'm doing a loop through Arizona, Nevada, and California, visiting a number of my current recommendations, kicking the tires on a couple of prospective new ones in the mining space. And in a lot of these cases, these are CEOs I'm talking to who have already had past successes. So if you've got a successful jockey, that's one of the first things you look for, is that somebody who's this isn't their first rodeo. They've had successful companies in the past. They've sold them, made a lot of money for their shareholders. Now they're doing it again. One this glorious example of one that I just visited this past week as we're recording this, it comes to immediately to mind. By the same token, when you have a good jockey, a company, especially if it's an exploration company, you want to make sure that they can raise the money that is sufficient to prove up their resource, to put something into production, whatever. We had a lot of lean years after that peak in 2011, particularly when it really was hard, even for good projects, to raise money. Who wanted to put money into junior mining when gold went from 1900, crashed back down to several hundred dollars? The gold stocks and silver stocks all went down. Who the hell wanted them? And so even good companies couldn't raise money. That has changed a fair bit. And so today I always tell people something, and not sarcastically, that if you're looking at a company that you've got some information on or somebody's telling you about it and say, boy, they got a great project. It's just too bad they can't raise money. Today, in this market in the recent past, if you can't raise the money that you need, it's because you're not good enough, very simply. So you want to look at the ability of the company to raise money and get broader embracing in the capital markets and among the smart investors who know that they need to be putting money to work in these areas. Moving on from that, you look at a lot of things. Probably the next broad important one is the jurisdiction that the project is in. It was out. I just watched in the last couple of nights. I'm going to be sharing this really good segment, an insightful segment in the copper space on Bloomberg's Wall Street Week. It was this last Friday night, the 17th of April. If you want to look it up, Google it, you'll find it. They interviewed Vicky Pici, the CEO of Resolution Copper, which, if that was producing right now in Arizona, would single-handedly be providing about a third of America's burgeoning needs for copper. And they're still trying to fight their way towards being able to produce this thing. And one of the quotes in that segment was, in the US of A, the average total time from the discovery of a mineral project to development, construction, and exploitation is, hold your breath, 30 years, nearly. Specifically, they said 29. It's well over 20 years in all cases. And that just shouldn't be. So it's tough. It's getting better. I'm often critical of the Trump administration. One of the things that they have done that is very sensible and necessary, though still not enough of this, in my opinion, is they've sped up the permitting process. They've got their Fast 41 designation, which has been applying to silver and gold as well as base metals. So, but realize the risk that is involved from jurisdiction risk, permitting, a lot of these different kind of things that also play into picking a stock or a specific company that you want to invest in. Of course, there's the property itself. Okay. And one of the things I've said in the recent past is that, and again, thankfully, since we have not yet seen a broad retail investor mania in precious metals, that didn't happen in this last run-up. So that means that is still going to come down the road when we're in our next leg higher for precious metals, silver and gold, and probably some other things will fall into this category as well. And we'll really see some stupid high prices. It might mean that the secular move is going to take a bigger hiatus than what we're in right now. But you've got to ask yourself when you're looking at something, is the potential news here, the potential discovery, the potential economic report that's going to be coming out, is it going to be so much greater that its neighbors and its peers that it's going to garner a disproportionate amount of investor attention and investor money? There's a lot of good projects out there that'll be economic that even in today's market aren't going to wow anybody. And I follow a few of them. Ones that and I'm just going to throw a few numbers out there for sake of discussion. You got 1 million ounces of gold in the resource right now, and if we do this, this, and this, and spend this much money, we can grow up to 1.5 million. Okay, that's nice, and it's down the road you're going to make money. That's not going to animate people right now who are paying attention to the gold space. Certainly not generalist investors and drag them back in. But if you've got a chance to grow 1 million ounces into five, that'll get their attention. So those of you who have followed me, or if you go and look at the various companies that I've got covered on my YouTube channel, most of them fall into that latter category. They're ones that, in the exploration ones at least, that have got the chance for quantum increases in resources that will be attention getting, not only to the markets, but of course, eventually to potential acquirers. Because the big companies are always on the lookout for where their next ounces of gold or silver or whatever is going to come from down the road. Also, in looking at these resources or potential for resource expansion, is what kind of resource is it? And this gets into the weeds a little bit on stuff that a lot of people don't have the technical knowledge for. But, ounces of gold in the ground are not created equal. 5 million ounces of gold in the ground that's low grade and deep and complicated geological setting that's going to take a lot of breaking it away is not the same as the same number of ounces in a place that's near surface that is not mated with too many other chemicals and you can recover mostly with gravity. So you've got to look at those factors as well. I was following a company for a while that had a great shtick as far as being able to resurrect a certain gold district and show that there's a lot of open pit potential where some narrow mining had been done in the past, but this is all troubled ore. Now they have some legal issues surrounding the company, and I'm glad that we long since got out of that and left that behind. I like the people involved, but it's just a troubled story. So it takes a lot of tire kicking. You got to know what you're doing, or look to someone that, again, a selfish commercial like myself, to know how to distinguish the better opportunities from the others. Another thing these days, and a lot of the stocks that have had nice moves in the recent past, even if they've given some back in this correction, is again, the types of investors now that are paying attention. And again, less retail investors who are more impressionable from juicy stories, even if they're not solid, but family offices, investment funds, and things like that. They're all about right now, show me the money. If you've got present production, near-term production, or like here's a chart that I haven't used yet. A lot of people in the industry, and this is a good, easy thing for you to remember if you're kind of a novice, there's two major points in a life cycle of a mining project where you have a quantum increase in the share price and valuation. Once is during the discovery phase. A lot of people write up the share price for the initial discovery. The news comes out, bingo, we found it. And now there's no new news to come out right away. A lot of people sell. And then when the reality of actually exploiting and developing the project sets in and the economics look good, you'll get another big move up. Usually that second move is of more sophisticated investors and more cautious ones too, who now it's all about show me the money. Okay, now the money's going to come. All right. And that, of course, that I just showed you is what's called the Lassonde curve, named for one of the legends in the industry, major investor and corporate head in this industry for years, Pierre Lassonde. So those are just some of the highlights, the major things you want to look at. I've for time's sake, which we've already spent a lot, I want to keep it relatively short and sweet, but also with the meat that you need. Really, the last thing you need to consider in here with the overall allocation of precious metals, folks, is how much of a portfolio should you have in the space. And again, when for my purposes, when we're at a place like we're at right now, where you're kind of in a gray area, I've commented recently that to me the precious metals are still having a flashing yellow caution light. It's not a green light like it was for pretty much all last year into the beginning of 2026. You want to keep your allocation down, taking some profits that we booked last year and so forth. The bottom number that a lot of professional quote financial planners will recommend is 5 or 10% of a portfolio. I'm more like 15% or a little higher than that. When I see the things get put back in a place that tell me that the Fed has capitulated, going to print more money, we're going to restart a bigger quantitative easing program, we're just going to add a zero, et cetera, then we're going to be a whole lot higher than 15% or 20%, I'll tell you that. But we're not there again yet. This is a time, and it's really a good time in particular to be looking at the individual company stories out there that are the best, because as I said, about a 20% drop from top to bottom in a recent gold price correction itself, more like a 35 to maybe 40% drop, whatever it was, top to bottom in silver. Both of them, of course, in recent days have rallied and gotten some of that back from the bottom of each of the prices. That still led to a lot of really good companies being cut in half. And so this to me is a time right now, if you got X number of dollars put aside, don't spend it all necessarily right this minute. But no reason right now you shouldn't be accumulating the better stories out there among both producers and exploration companies. And of course, that again is one of the big reasons why we're here today. And there you have it. This certainly is not your father's or grandfather's gold market or silver market. Certainly not like even when I got into this industry back in the late 1970s. A lot has changed. The proportion of people involved and invested in precious metals has overall declined over the years, but there are those times, and I've tried to give you the best explanation I can of how and why they come about from time to time when that changes, and it is actionable in a broad way to be invested. And also, I wanted to point out that the circumstances that we're in today with the end of financial repression, with debt going kablooey and all this other kind of thing, is inevitably going to bring, I think, larger percentages of investors back into this space as well. And so the whole purpose of this exercise is to give you a reasonable approach to this space, not a religious one. So you know when to zig and when to zag, how to choose companies, how to do all of this properly, what to do, what not to do, et cetera. And I hope I've done a good job for you on that. If you have any questions, I pride myself, not always in the 5 minutes after you send it to me, but especially if you need to give me a nudge or two. I love to answer questions. In fact, most every issue of the National Investor is at least partly talking about the markets, the macro world, everything else, individual companies, as the case may be, based on questions that our audience sends in. So don't hesitate to drop me a line to chris@nationalinvestor.com. If you have a question, a comment, curious about something, I'll get to you eventually, I promise. And other than that, I hope that you get a lot out of this, that it's a benefit long term for you and your portfolio. Keep in touch, and thanks for tuning in.
We're glad you joined us today. As always, write to chris@nationalinvestor.com with your comments and questions. And be sure to visit yourmoneytoday.org if you haven't already. Sign up for our free alerts, notifications of new shows, and more. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.